I am a child of modernity. I was born in the future-facing world of 1960 to parents whose main imaginal myth seemed to be the great American dream. Their kind of attitude to life was mostly work hard so you can get a new fitted kitchen and have Spanish holidays and be happy, therefore. That was their sort of creed. Certainly wasn't sensible to let any messy emotional stuff in, because that really wasn't sensible and would, you know, not help anything. And you really don't need to worry about the world, because the scientists will take care of that. It'll all be fine. So, quite clear. And of course, this had a big effect. I practiced hard according to their faith, actually. I tried very hard. I got a scientific education, worked hard at school. By the time I was 24, I had a professional career. I was married with my own home, my own fitted kitchen, and I was having holidays further afield than Spain. I identified with that sort of side of me quite heavily for, you know, 3 or 4 decades, something like that. And life lacked something. Sort of, that wasn't enough. That wasn't everything. I'm a child of imagination. I grew up visited regularly by Father Christmas with his tinkling sleigh bells. Very reliable, very abundantly generous. That was very wonderful. It was a real magical happening in my life. And we went to the local library, I think, every week when I was quite a small child. So I was sort of immersed in the world of fiction. I was always reading a lot. And I loved reading. I loved especially anything that was kind of, a bit magical or, unusual. Anything with extraordinary happenings in that you couldn't quite explain. Particularly, actually, anything that kind of had another realm in it. I was particularly fascinated with, you know, the realm behind the back of the wardrobe or beyond the looking glass. I can't actually remember really much about what happens in those stories, but it was that sort of transition from one world to another one that was just so close that sort of fascinated me. Just being there, but you didn't normally know. I was also well immersed in the Christian myths, both at school and at Sunday school, chapel and then church. So I sort of knew those well and responded to them, actually. They were part of my life. And of course, this had a big effect. I still love losing myself in a good novel, or a film, or a play, or those kind of other worlds that we enter in those ways. This part of me is kind of closer to my emotional being, and it brings colour and meaning into my life. But so much of that magic was discarded with childhood. The way those things were a bit sort of unreal makes me mistrustful of that way of functioning, that way of being in the world as well. It wasn't true, was it? It wasn't reasonable, wasn't right. One of the main themes of my Dharma life really has been trying to reconcile these two aspects of myself, trying to kind of work out what to do with them. I call them my scientist and my poet, although I don't do any science or write much poetry, but kind of get the feeling of those. And they each bring important qualities, important faculties into my life and into my engagement with the Dharma. And sometimes they dance together, which is wonderful, but quite often they undermine each other. They kind of poke at each other and drag the ground out from under each other. Or they just take turns to be in charge. I kind of leap from one to the other, and neither of those quite works, which I'll say more about later. I'm telling you about this because it's the kind of backdrop to this theme that I want to introduce in these 4 weeks. Reconciling them is very much a work in process, so it's sort of, and this talk is very much a part of it. It's like I realise one of the reasons this talk was proving a bit kind of convoluted to pull together was because it's something that's so sort of convoluted in me, and it was something about that that I needed to say. So this talk is very much part of that process. So that's I kind of feel like I have to tell you about it in a way. Because in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be introducing, as Pranimati said, the cosmic mythic vision of the Mahayana Sutras. I'll do that particularly in the next couple of weeks. In week four, I'll come back a bit to like, what's this got to do with us a bit more directly. And yeah, these sutras are amazing works of the spiritual imagination. A sutra is the name for a Buddhist discourse. It literally means thread in Pali, which the early texts are in its sutta. So sutta or sutra means thread. So it's like suture, the medical term for a stitch. It stitches things together and gives you a threaded discourse on a topic. And the Mahayana sutras particularly are part of one of the great trends in Buddhism, one of the great movements, the movement that arose probably 400 or 500 years after the Buddha's life. And it had many aspects, some of which will come out in the next couple of weeks. But overall, I think it really was in different ways countering various different trends of tightness and literalism that were kind of starting to set in, certain rigidity to the way people were interpreting the Buddha's teachings. So just in different ways breaking that open. The Mahayana texts include sublime works of philosophy, things that you can kind of engage with your rational mind, that kind of confound your rational mind, take you beyond that. But I'm particularly going to be looking at the works of imagination, the works of imagination and myth, symbol, archetype that some of the Mahayana sutras are full of. So yeah, they're really expressing a spiritual vision, a vast spiritual vision in cosmic, beautiful imagery, which it's expressing a vision that's a picture of what human life is about, human potential, what our place is in the cosmos. And they're wacky. They're like psychedelically kind of ornate and grand and enormous, which is a bit of a problem for my rational side. So, you know, I thought it might be for some of you too, which is why I realised I needed to give this talk before I could just plunge in. My poet just wanted to go, let's just read the sutras and see what they make of it and it'll be fine. And you know, my scientist is going, can't you remember what that was like when you first met them? And they'll be saying, it'll just be really off-putting if you don't give some explanation. And in a way, I needed to do it for me to kind of satisfy that side of myself before I was kind of free to plunge straight in. If you try and read these sutras straight, some of them on the shrine, they're pretty incomprehensible, actually. They're pretty hard work. And you'll soon find you really do need a commentary. The ones I'm most familiar with are the three sutras which Sangharakshita Bhante has given commentaries on. There's a series of 8 lectures on the White Lotus Sutra, the Sutra of Golden Light, and the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, all of which I studied in Mitra study many years ago when I was a Mitra. So I really recommend all of those lectures are in this wonderful book, Mahayana Myths and Stories. They're all available as the original lectures online to listen to as well. But really getting to grips with them with a group of people in a Mitra group is really the way to kind of really familiarise yourself, discuss that. So become a Mitra, do Mitra study, is the answer. The other imaginal sutras I'm quite familiar with are the Pure Land Sutras, which we were looking at on our rainy season retreat last week, which was really wonderful. And I really recommend Ratnaguna's book on that. It's a really good read. It's got loads of basic Dharma in, really makes clear. It's not, it's a commentary on the sutras. It's a really good Sri Ratna Dharma book, very sort of generally applicable and makes a lot of sense of them. I really recommend that. You can get his talks online too. You can find those on our website. They're not on Free Buddhist Audio yet. So yeah, I'm telling you about my poet and my scientist because I hope it'll be helpful to you, because I hope other people will recognise these aspects in themselves. I don't really think I'm alone in it. Indeed, in my explorations lately, I've discovered that the ancient Greek books had terms for these trends of mind, these tendencies, these ways of seeing and thinking about the world. They called them logos, logical thinking, reasonable thinking, and mythos, sort of the imaginal, mythic way of engaging with the world. So I think if they've been around since the ancient Greeks recognised them, it's probably not just me. And the Buddha used both in his communication. He could communicate in concepts and he could communicate in images and stories and, you know, that kind of way of doing. So there's lots of examples right in the early teachings of the Buddha. So in this talk, I'm going to tell you a couple of things that I've found helpful lately in thinking about this material. I'm going to tell you a bit about the history of myth because I've found it really helpful to think about the context in which these sutras arose and the context in which we're reading them, kind of what is it that we're bringing to them from our world. And I'm just going to give you a little smattering of neuroscience because that pleases my scientist and interests me. And then I'll just come back a little bit to like how to approach the sutras or why I love them, what they're about for me. So what is myth? Do we need it? And what can we learn from thinking about the history, the historical context of myth? We so often use the word myth, like we do the word imagination, to mean not true and irrelevant, you know, just sort of nothing to it. But there's more to it than that. And we do use those words in a way quite particularly in Triratna. We do really understand the importance of myth. And when we say imagination, we mean something more than just sort of fantasy, which I'll touch on again near the end. The myths, you could say, are the big collective stories that humankind tells to make sense of and to deal with the human predicament. We're all in this life, much the same boat, and what's it all about? Our stories about that shape how we experience the world. And again, I think you start to see that when you think about how myth has been at different eras in human history. But yeah, what is it all about? I mean, you're born, you live through a mixture of struggle and joy, delight, ease, suffering. If you're lucky, a few touches of the transcendent, of the sacred. And you die. What is it all about? So, since we've been making tools, since, you know, stone tools, people have had stories. They've made told myths to make sense of it all, make sense of life. In a way, myths like a kind of psychology for sort of understanding how the mind works, for understanding how we relate to the world, how we are with each other. And it's a way of extending our imagination into what we don't understand and to ask, what if, what's more? But yeah, I think it's just inevitable. Human beings are storytellers. We're makers of meaning. We do it all the time. We can't stop it. You can do that in a kind of helpful way or an unhelpful way, a creative way or a reactive way. You can fill the gaps in your understanding of what's going on with negative stories or helpful stories. It's what we do. And it's, I think, what makes us human, actually. It's what's particular about human beings, as far as we know, as Karen Armstrong says, dogs, as far as we know, do not agonise about the canine condition, worry about the plight of dogs in other parts of the world, or try to see their lives from a different perspective. But human beings do those sorts of things, not so much about dogs, perhaps, or some of you might, but I don't worry much about dogs in other parts of the world. And yet we tend to be dominated by logos, by logic, ration, rational mind in our world now. We've got this sort of sophisticated rational worldview, which makes it hard for us to accept even the creative stories of what the world's about. And I think we find it hard, you know, all the time I'm telling the story of me, all the time. And I imagine most of you are probably, unless you're enlightened, you're all the time narrating who you are and what's going on in your world. So we do that all the time. But I think we find it quite hard to accept the stories of us, or really engage with those together, the stories of who we all are and what we're doing together. Partly because we sense the power of that, actually, and because we've seen some of the results of that in history. In a way, Nazism was a collective myth, wasn't it? It was sort of like something that people really signed up for and were passionate about. Yet, yeah, as I was saying, humanity has created myth, lived with myth, since we made the first stone tools. The hunters needed heroic myths to inspire them to go out and do difficult, dangerous things on their own beyond the tribe. They needed initiation rituals to help them into that way of being. The agricultural age needed myths of earth and harvest and prosperity and calling on the forces of nature to harvest for them. And for these people, the whole question of how seriously to take myth just didn't arise like it does for us. It's like they lived the myth. That was their experience. It was how they understood the world, how they experienced the world, how they interacted with the world. That was how they explained their life completely. It was just part of their experience. Karen Armstrong's got quite a lot to say about this, but a little summary bit. In our scientific culture, we often have rather simplistic notions of the divine. In the ancient world, the gods were rarely regarded as supernatural beings with discrete personalities, living a totally separate metaphysical experience. Mythology was not about theology in the modern sense, but about human experience. People thought that gods, humans, animals, and nature were inextricably bound up together, subject to the same laws, and composed of the same divine substance. There was initially no ontological gulf between the world of gods and the world of men and women. When people spoke of the divine, they were usually talking about an aspect of the mundane. The very existence of the gods was inseparable from that of a storm, a sea, a river, or from those powerful human emotions, love, rage, or sexual passion, that seemed momentarily to lift men and women onto a different plane of existence so that they saw the world with new eyes. You just glimpse that possibility where the world is alive, and the sort of power of your emotions and the power of the natural forces of the world are just sort of, they're not sort of separate, and the whole way you're understanding the world is just, yeah, very, very alive. The world's alive. It's a very sort of unseparated kind of way of being in relation to things. Once some civilizations started to form, cities and towns, urbanization started to form, this kind of connection to nature started to weaken a bit, and human endeavour started to become more important than the kind of natural forces of things. For some cities, at least, which weren't too subject to the floods and famines and things, the forces of nature started to be a bit more remote, and their mythologies reflected that. But by the time of the Buddha, people still had a very different experience of the world than we do today. Still much less separate from nature and from this sort of sense of the mythical world. They had a very different experience of time. They didn't write, and that makes a big difference. to your sort of understanding of your perception of time. If you write in a linear way and you can record what happened when in that way, that fixes things in this sort of way. If you don't, it's just all much more fluid and of a piece. So they didn't have the same linear chronological sort of sense of history that we have in those days. It's worth listening to Ratnaguna's first talk from the rainy season retreat, where he uses the film Arrival to bring out that sort of non-linear sense of you know, time and language in a way that our language shapes our perception and vice versa. They're very sort of, our consciousness and our language are very closely related. Very interesting. So in the time of the Buddha, there was much less concern than we have with what really actually happened, what the truth of events were. They were much more concerned with what it meant than what it was, with that sort of meaning. We are concerned above all with what actually happened. But in the pre-modern world, when people wrote about the past, they were more concerned with what an event had meant. A myth was an event which, in some sense, had happened once, but which also happened all the time. Because of our strictly chronological view of history, we have no word for such an occurrence. But mythology is an art form that points beyond history to what is timeless in human existence, helping us to get beyond the chaotic flux of random events and glimpse the core of reality. A myth is an event which in some sense has happened once, but which also happens all the time. People in the Buddha's world also just took for granted the existence of non-human, non-animal beings. You get it all the time in the early texts. The Buddha is teaching devas, these beings of light and bliss, that it's like, we don't even know how to think about that really, what that means. But they, he doesn't just teach human beings, he teaches gods and men, gods and people. And people seem to talk in that way. When the Buddha was first enlightened, his was obviously so striking that someone came up to him and wanted to know what sort of being he was. Sort of, are you a god? Are you a man? But he kind of went through a few other categories of, spirits and things that we don't have. So people sort of expected to meet these other kind of beings in the world. They had this sort of mythic, connected with nature relationship with things, which it's hard for us to really imagine what it'd be like to experience the world in that way, I think. So the Buddha lived in the Axial Age, which was a time of extraordinary upheaval and creativity, a time when many major prophets emerged, a sort of era of the forming of a lot of the major world religions that are still with us. And at that time, the big myths started to get more concerned with human suffering and how to make sense of that, and more concerned with individual morality and introspection than with external rights to kind of manipulate the external world and call the forces of nature under, to your wish. And so that was the case with the Buddha too. He was really, he attacked some of the existing rites and rituals that were going on, the Vedic rites, particularly the ones that were sacrificial, because he could see that was cruel and unhelpful. He attacked the caste system. But some aspects of the existing kind of cosmology and the gods and things, he sort of adopted, gave new meaning to, refreshed. So again, in the stories you get, he refers to or meets Brahma Sahampati, who's some sort of chief god. He meets Mara, the sort of undermining forces that are doubting and pulling him back from his quest. So we understand that kind of quite psychologically. In a way, perhaps Buddhism's always been quite sort of psychological. It's had stories for aspects of our psyche, for our inner life, our inner world, personifications of that. But our culture actually is probably a lot more based in classical Greek culture, in ancient Greece. So a lot of that emerged also in the Axial Age, and that's the kind of bit that's formed our thinking. And there in ancient Greece, where they talked about logos and mythos, Plato considered logos was superior. That was what made you human, was this rational ability to reason. That was the important thing, more than mythos. And Aristotle agreed, and they tried to sort of read the myths as though they were philosophy, which meant they didn't make sense, and, you know, because that's not kind of how they're meant to be read. It's the wrong, using the wrong part of the mind to try and understand something somehow. They did accept that there were things that reason couldn't deal with, couldn't, places it couldn't go, and said that was the realm of myth. But yeah, in a way, philosophy, the development of philosophy seems to have created this sort of split we have between myth and reason, this sort of contradiction in us, this root of unease we have with being with myth, mythic thought. So I think that's just right there through Western thought, and that's part of what we bring to thinking about this sort of material. And then, of course, the place of myth and imagination was really fully devalued in the 18th century Age of Reason. The new gods were, you know, rational thinking, reason, individual liberty, self-reliance. And that sort of worldview, along with the stunning success of science to manipulate the external world and actually relieve a lot of suffering and give us a lot of progress and possibilities for human life, have really thoroughly demoted myth and imagination and ritual to the status of superstition and, you know, something a bit more primitive that we want to move ourselves away from or have done. Lots of us are also very influenced by Christianity, that being such a big part of the culture of our country. And Christianity has a rich and powerful mythology, which I think it's often rather misunderstood for itself. Again, it's sort of used the wrong faculty to engage with it. I think Christianity struggled because it's tried to make rational sense or to believe. It's put so much emphasis on belief. It's very important to sign up to the creed where you believe in God, where you believe the universe was created by God in this particular way, rather than understanding that as a myth that has some sort of truth that you can kind of relate to spiritually. If you try and think of it literally and then hold it up against science, and, you know, you just get into kind of a real muddle. So I think there's a lot of power in those myths. There's a lot to read into them, but only if you know them as myths. And I think Christianity sometimes forgot that they were myths and took them too seriously, and in a way self-destructed because of it. I think that's really undermined, you know, their own credibility for themselves in a lot of cases. I'm sure there are Christians with much more sophisticated understanding of their faith, but I think, you know, that has been a trend within that faith. And yeah, I just found it really helpful to think about this kind of insistence on belief and whether I've brought that with me into the Dharma, because I think I have. For a long time, I really struggled because I couldn't decide how to know, how to believe in enlightenment. When I was sort of, for my first years in the Dharma, I thought, I don't know whether it's true or not that the Buddha got enlightened, that enlightenment is a possibility for any of us. It's beyond our experience, that's the whole kind of point of it. So I can't prove it in my experience, and there's no way to know whether it's true or not, and I don't know. And I got like really troubled. It's like, if I don't believe in it, I can't be a Buddhist. But, you know, it was a sort of real problem for me for some years. And, actually, what you believe in the sense of what your views are important to Buddhism, but there's so much else to it. It's so much about practice. It's not just about doctrine and having that right. There's actually very, very little doctrine you need. But how you live shapes you. That matters. And yeah, transforming our views matters, transforming our emotions, transforming our actions. All of those are aspects of faith that we gradually deepen as we practice. So I think when I started to think, oh, well, I'm sort of doing it anyway, and I like what it produces in my life, that was kind of, I could start to loosen the worrying about whether or not enlightenment was really true in that scientific sort of way. So yeah, I really appreciated reading this short history of myth by Karen Armstrong and really thinking about how formed I am by all of that, how conditioned I am by the prevailing worldviews and the kind of history and context that we're brought up in, and how different that is than what was around in the time of the Buddha. I could see how the kind of prevailing view of the world supports and strengthens my scientist and makes it less straightforward to find a relationship with imagination and myth and ritual on its own terms. And then I can start to feel a bit less bound by it when I can sort of see that, well, that's one way of looking at things and it's optional. There are other ways of looking at things. And yeah, and I think we do all share quite a lot of those factors. But then I still want to know, in a way, why myth matters or how it works, what it's really sort of for. We say in our beginner's course, in the intermediate course, that symbol, myth and archetype speak to and transform the unconscious depths of our psyche, our deeper emotional world, because that speaks their language, and I think that's very, very true. I think that's how it works. We're sort of doing something in a way that we don't quite understand when we're engaging with myth and imagination and ritual. We don't understand it in the rational mind, the logos way. So yeah, we say it's transforming the unconscious depths, and I was thinking about that and just wondering what our model for that is for the unconscious. I think I certainly have this sense that, like, what I know of myself is like a tip of an iceberg, and there's this mass under there which kind of isn't under my control, and I don't really know what's going on with it. And I tend to be pretty suspicious of that. I think from kind of, you know, Freud onwards, we've kind of slightly viewed the unconscious as a bit of a problem, or a, you know, sort of a, yeah, it's kind of got nasty lurking things in the depths and something to kind of worry about a bit. In the introductory course, we use the image of it being like a medieval great hall deep in a cellar somewhere with all these fantastic beings in, with kings and queens and warriors and wizards and bards and all sat around half asleep and covered in cobwebs and kind of not quite being bothered to wake up and engage with life. And, you know, we say we really need to use myth and imagination to wake them up and engage them and give them something to be interested in, because that's the language they speak. So to kind of bring our inner world to life, we need this language. So that's very true. And yeah, there's lots of other ways you could kind of image what this unconscious part of us is, what goes on without our knowledge or our control, and how we could influence that. So because my scientist likes a bit of science, I found some sort of studies in Harari's Homo Deus, which I also read on solitary. I did lots of reading on my 3-week solitary this summer. Very interesting. There's masses in here which is really interesting. There's like loads. He says quite a lot about myth as collective imagination, which I'll perhaps come back to in week 4. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about just one particular little bit that grabbed me most recently, where he's describing some studies on epileptics who, in the middle of the last century, if it was really severe, the only treatment they could sort of offer was to sever the connection between right brain and left brain, which sounds pretty drastic, but gives you a really interesting subject to do some experiments with. So the left brain carries most of our ability to speak, our sort of language areas, and logic and reason, and it takes data from and controls the right-hand side of the body. So the left controls the right and gets input, sensory input from the right, and vice versa. So that's the left brain. The right brain deals with the left side of the body and does more of this spatial processing, spatial information. So it's not kind of strictly split into the two, but that's kind of how it goes. So the right side doesn't have a lot of language ability. It can't speak. But it seems it can know and act. It is influenced. So there's a few really great studies. So there was one where they showed this patient some pictures, and they somehow, I suppose by covering the other eye or something, showed the left brain, as it were, a picture of a chicken claw, and the right brain a snow scene, and then said, "What did you see?" And the guy says, "A chicken claw," because that's what the language producing part of the brain had seen. And then they said, "Okay, pick from this selection of picture cards pictures that the picture that's most like, you know, most to do with the picture you saw." And simultaneously, the guy's right hand picked up a picture of a chicken and his left hand picked up a snow shovel. So it's like that part of the brain couldn't say anything about it, didn't know what it had seen, but it knew somehow that the snow shovel connected with the snow scene. Just sort of. Then they asked him why he picked up both. And he said, "Oh, well, the snow shovel would be needed to clean out the chicken shed." So he still didn't consciously know anything about all that going on, but it was happening. And I just found that really intriguing somehow, really fascinating. There were a couple of other things. There was another one where they showed someone with the side of her brain where she couldn't form language, a pornographic image, and she blushed and giggled. And they said, "What did you see?" And she said, "Just a flash of light." She didn't have any awareness of what she'd seen. And they said, "So why are you laughing?" And she said, "One of those machines looks a bit funny." It's like, so she's making up an explanation, like the guy was with the chicken shed shovel. And that's just must be what we do all the time. It's like we must be getting all this input that we don't even know we're getting, and then we're telling ourselves a story to make sense of it. And I just found that, yeah, just like really, really fascinating. And when you couple that with all the research about how, if you're all wired up to the right scanners and things, people can tell you've made a decision from the impulses in your brain seconds before you know you've made a decision or before you act on it. It's like the decision's happened before you know anything about it. It really starts to undermine my sense of having a kind of self that's in control of anything, that's deciding or knowing what's going on at all. I just found that really interesting. But yeah, the thing with the images that weren't registered just really also, the whole thing, it reminds me how much I identify with my narrator and my scientist, with the bit that tries to explain and make sense. I think that's who I am. And it just shows that something doesn't have to kind of make sense or be explicable to be having an effect on us. The right brain can take in and be affected by images without us even really knowing what's happening or what's going on. You see a snow scene, part of you knows that you need the snow shovel. Something's going on in there. And so I just think somehow that, to me, gave some suggestion about why it matters really what we fill our minds with. It really matters what's shaping us in that image kind of world. Somehow that's giving us a way of being in the world without us really knowing what's going on. our minds are very fluid, very flexible, and we're setting up different patterns in them all the time. We could be creating a whole experience of the world. Ratnaguna explains very well that a lot of these sutras he thinks weren't meant to be sort of read like we read a novel. They're meant to be read ritually as a collective practice. It's meant just like you just kind of enact it in a way. You just say it and let that affect you. You're kind of creating an image together of the world, and somehow that's patterning who you are. And so I think, you know, we could have a life like that. We could have a life filled with sacred texts and gorgeous images, with ritual, with prayer, with a wonderful story that we're kind of filling our life with to give it meaning. And that's really sort of how I want to live. That's how I want to live, just for the sake of it, because that seems the only way to be, really. That seems to be what matters. Mankind can't live by logos alone, nor actually by mythos alone. We need to understand the creative use of both of them and let them really interact. I found a little piece on mythos and logos by someone called Lech Witkowski on YouTube. I don't really know who he is, but he was saying, if you're trapped in just logos, you're not sensitive to the mystery, the sacred, the unknowable, the unspeakable, the realm of the sacred. If we stick to mythos and can't combine the two, we're trapped in our sentiments, in hatred, superiority, and we can justify dramatic violence. So I think that's some of our fears of myth, actually, some of those things. So it's like we really have to keep the two alive. So I need to use my discerning rational mind. It has uses. I can use it, I mean, in a way it can create a lot of cynicism, a lot of doubt, but I can use it to counter doubt by looking at the results of practice in my experience, in my life. Is something happening that's creative, meaningful, opening? Is that happening? Is it working? I can use my discerning rational mind to check experience against the Dharma, to see if it's, you know, my interpretation, my understanding of what's going on is consistent with the Dharma, particularly whether it's ethical. We've got that, always got that fallback check. Is this going to lead me? Is it leading me to behave ethically? And actually, we need it. We need that, you know, reason and speech function to be able to narrate our experience, to be able to communicate with each other. It's pretty important that we do that. But if I only use my rational mind, it doesn't work. Life goes flat and grey and loses its beauty, loses its life, its interest. And actually, it doesn't work for engaging with the Dharma. One of the reasons I love these imaginal texts is because it invites me to engage in an imaginal way. Some of the more sort of philosophical things I easily can engage with as if there's something to get or achieve or understand, and it sort of narrows me down into this trying to get it sort of thing. So actually those texts too need to be heard as though they're poetry, or they're all pointing at something beyond. They're all sort of not quite what they seem. So it's much better if I can listen to the Dharma, listening, as one of my friends says, for words of power, listening for what moves me, what vibrates in my depths. Listen more like poetry. Or Sangharakshita says we should listen to the Mahayana Sutras as though they're science fiction, transcendental science fiction, which is quite a good guide. But if I only use my emotions or my imaginal faculty, or I engage with imaginal material in a sort of literal way or a shallow way, then that leaves me really prone to cynical doubt, because it just gets to seem like, well, it's not true and it's a bit silly and what's the point of all this? So I need to engage my rational mind to kind of make sense of it too, which in a way is what I've been talking about this evening. So neither of them works on their own, really. Neither of them gets you very far. But when both faculties are both really alive, when they're dancing together, something else can happen. It's like you do enter an illumined world, a world of beauty and significance, of imagination with a capital I. This is what we mean by imagination. When we say we need to use our imagination, we don't mean we need to play pretend particularly, although sometimes you might, because that can have an effect too. We mean we need to bring reason and emotion together to have a much deeper, more open, more alive experience of life. We can use it to not to opt out of life, but to live more intensely, more vividly, more really in touch with things. So yeah, I love the mythic vision of the Mahayana. I love it because it is such a sublime vision. It's the most sublime, inspiring, big view of what human life is about that I've come across. It's the most meaningful pointer to our potential and our interrelatedness and kind of where we are in the world, what that's all about. But actually, I love them because they really help to awaken this imagination, this imaginal faculty. Because they're so wacky, because they're so psychedelically vast, that I know not to take them literally. Some bits of Dharma I'm kind of not quite sure how to kind of approach, but this is so, like, the more kind of weird and wonderful it is, the more clear it is that I'm not supposed to think it's really true. I'm not supposed to think there's 60 quintillion Buddhas in the universe, you know, in a way that I'm going to kind of see them or something. It's like it's too much for the mind to hold, so it sort of breaks something open. And, yeah, it can just be very beautiful. So it awakens this sort of attitude of deep receptivity and faith, this way of really being in the world that's open to that. And all of the Dharma is like that. It's all trying to show us something that's really beyond words, something we can't express. And it's just really important to remember that. It's something, it's really trying to point us towards the mystery of life, the sacred, the divine, the transcendent. And I really want to live with an openness to that, an openness to the mystery beyond words, what's suggested by image, by poetry. I want to be touched by the sacred, by the divine, the transcendent. A myth is really about the unknown, about that for which we have no words. Sangharakshita quote, "Not for our own sake, not even for the sake of others, should we seek to attain the divine, but simply and solely for its own irresistible sake."